Well, thank you all for being here, and I'm very excited and very honored to be able to talk to you about this topic. I have many, many friends in the audience that I'm seeing here that I've known for so many years, and new friends as well. So it's just a real pleasure and exciting to be here. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about spiritual care in the United States. And again, this is a perspective from the United States. It may or may not relate to spiritual care here in Europe. So you'll have to take this information and adapt it to your own cultural setting here. So as far as of, you know, what I would like to talk about over the next hour, what is spiritual care? I'll give you my definition of it, basically, and thinking about it and what it might involve. Who provides spiritual care? What is the basis for spiritual care? In other words, why do it? What's the logic behind it? How often do health professionals provide spiritual care in the United States? There's some research data on that. And how do health professionals in the USA provide spiritual care? And then hopefully we'll have a little time for discussion. So here's the English book, and here's the German translation of it that just came out that's available. Has a wealth of information, including at the back of the book, it has information about various world religions and the kind of the relevant information that you need to know about when you're caring for someone from a different religion than your own. Some of the rituals that are involved in care towards the end of life and during chronic illness. So what is spiritual care? Part of care of the whole person. So I think we probably all agree on that a person is not just their physical body or their psychology or their social relationships, but it also involves another dimension that's called the spiritual dimension. Now, there are many definitions of spiritual, so I'm not going to dive into that controversy, but nevertheless, it's an important, I think we can all agree, that it is an important part of the person. So what spiritual care is not? Okay, so in my opinion, sometimes it's a good idea to try to sort things out a little bit by, you know, removing all pieces that maybe don't belong there. So in my opinion, spiritual care is not the same as providing medical or nursing care. That's provided by doctors and nurses. Okay, we've already got that. That's what we're already doing. So that's no addition to what is being done. Spiritual care is not the same as addressing the emotional and psychological needs of patients. That's what mental health specialists do. So we already have counselors and we have psychologists and psychiatrists that address the psychological and the social, you know, the psychological needs that people have, patients have. And spiritual care is not the same as addressing the social or family needs of patients. That's what social workers do. So kind of what are we left with? We've kind of done away with the medical and nursing care. We've kind of dispensed with the addressing of the psychological needs, explicitly psychological, and also the social needs. So what's left? So what is spiritual care? Spiritual care involves health professionals addressing that aspect of the whole person that has to do with their relationship to the transcendent and the spiritual needs that result from that relationship. That's what's unique about spiritual care, in my understanding. Is spiritual care the same as providing religious care? Yeah, in my understanding, it is. Broadly speaking. It is the only distinct aspect of spiritual care that separates and distinguishes it from physical, psychological, and social aspects of care. This idea, this connection to the transcendent. It's really, really the only new thing that's being introduced here. Okay, so what is involved in spiritual care? Practically speaking, spiritual care, at least in the United States, involves taking a spiritual history. In other words, talking with patients about these issues. Now, when I'm talking about spiritual care here, I'm primarily talking about what healthcare professionals, other than chaplains or pastors or ministers, I'm talking about what are doctors, nurses, social workers, occupational therapists, psychologists, what does it mean to them as opposed to, a professional in spiritual care or a chaplain? So it involves, these are non-religious healthcare professionals I'm talking about. It would be taking a spiritual history, talking with patients about these issues. That's really the primary aspect of spiritual care is communicating, talking about it with patients. One of the goals of spiritual care is to identify the spiritual needs that patients have. So the spiritual needs and ensuring that spiritual needs are met by someone. Most of the time, at least in the United States, nurses and doctors are so busy. They don't have the time, really, to be meeting patients' spiritual needs, nor do they have the training to do it. That requires expertise and training to meet the spiritual needs that are related to illness, medical or, psychiatric illness. And so there are experts around that can do that, and they should be utilized, just like you would, a family doctor wouldn't do a coronary artery bypass. They would refer somebody, the patient to somebody with some expertise who's received years of training on how to do that and how to do it right. And so we have those people, and I think you do too, in our healthcare settings. Now, believe it or not, in the United States, only about half of the hospitals have paid chaplains. So it's not like, all of the hospitals in the United States have all of this spiritual care available. They don't. Now, the last tier here is providing health care in a spiritual way, and I'll say a little bit more about each of those later, okay? But first of all, I wanted to talk about, chaplains and other clergy, pastors, counselors, provide spiritual care, but also medical doctors, nurses, social workers, and other health professionals as well. Okay, so that I just wanted to kind of repeat that. I already said that, but I want to kind of emphasize that's kind of what I'm focusing on, or these people here. So now we go on to why provide spiritual care. Everybody is busy. Nobody has any time. There's a tremendous amount of information that has to be learned by doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals. It's growing all the time. Why should we take this precious time that we have very little of to address these issues? That's kind of a basic question. Why is this relevant? Well, here are a few reasons why we should take the time to do this. One is that many patients are religious and would like it to be addressed in their health care. So we'll look at that in the next slide. Many patients have spiritual needs related to illness that could affect their mental, social, and physical health. So we're going to look at that. Two, religious beliefs of patients affect health care decisions and could conflict with medical care and the medical care plan. So that's a really good reason to at least talk with patients about these issues, because if they have beliefs that are going to conflict with their complying with the medical or nursing care plan, then by golly, we should know about those. I mean, as medical professionals caring for them, we need to know those beliefs would conflict with the care or that might require a kind of a different form of care, different approach to care, because of those religious and cultural beliefs. Also, religious beliefs of health professionals, doctors and nurses, affect their health care decisions and could conflict with the patient's beliefs. Okay, so that's actually been shown that that the attitudes and beliefs, religious beliefs of doctors, influence the decisions they make, many, many medical decisions that doctors make. Pain medication, whether or not to prescribe pain medication for someone in pain, certainly many decisions related to end-of-life care, including issues related to euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. Many, many different issues related to contraception, and it's the religious beliefs of the healthcare professional that is directing many of these decisions, regardless of what the patient feels. You know, in the U.S., and I think it's here too, but I'm not sure, we kind of focus on the patient. It's the patient's beliefs and needs, not the doctor's or the nurse's needs, that are the focus of care. It's the patient. Patient-centered medicine. So, in any case, we ought to talk about this. This is part of spiritual care. Spiritual care involves at least becoming aware of, acknowledging, and then discussing a little bit. Doesn't have to be, you know, a long time, but discussing these beliefs so that we come to some kind of common agreement here on this factor that we never otherwise discuss in healthcare settings. And haven't been discussing. Even the United States, only about 10% of physicians address these issues in clinical settings. Nurses aren't much better either in the United States. They may ask a patient, well, do you want to see a chaplain? What's your denomination? And that's it. You know, if we're lucky, those two things are checked on the box when they're admitted. And then finally, religion influences support and care in the community. And so, again, because of the high cost of health care, and I know you all are facing that too in your countries, that health care is about ready to bankrupt, at least us in the United States, and probably you too, because we've got older populations. We've got aging populations. And because medical care is so good, it helps keep people alive with chronic illness rather than just allowing them to die. That means they're around and they need care, and that can be very expensive, particularly chronic care can be very expensive. So what's happening now is that health care is beginning to shift. It's shifting from the hospital and even nursing homes to the community, but in particular the hospital, because hospital care costs the most money, acute inpatient care. So the length of hospital stay in the United States has become from, on average, in 1995 at Duke Hospital, it was 10.5 days in the hospital, 1995. Now it's about 2 to 3 days in the hospital, and then people go home. You know, whether they're ready to go home or not, they go home. They go back into the community. So care is shifting into the community now, away from the hospital, and then into the clinics too, the medical clinics. And that means people with chronic illness, there are going to be more and more people with chronic illness living in the community. And so they need support there. They need support in the community. So religious and faith communities often are an important source of support for people in the community in terms of monitoring them, providing social support, giving them rides to the doctor's office, ensuring that they take their medication, asking them, if they've had some of the preventative health care services as well. So faith communities can do all of those things, and that's another reason why this ought to be at least something that we discuss in the healthcare setting. Because the social worker could, as part of the discharge plan, include, perhaps, of course, with the patient's consent, could include kind of a care plan, a spiritual care plan that continues after hospitalization and continues in the community. That's provided by, perhaps, the faith community. Okay, those are just some ideas as to why to address these issues, and I'm going to kind of focus a little bit in on some of these other things now. So, okay. Many patients are religious, and most are spiritual. Again, depending on what you mean by spiritual. 40% now in the United States, this is the latest data available. It's barely 6 months old, so this is good data. 40% say they are very religious. Religion is an important part of daily life, weekly or almost weekly attendance. So people who do both of those are considered very religious, according to the Gallup polls that do the big random surveys of the population. So they say 40% say religion is an important part of daily life and attend religious services weekly or almost weekly. 28% are moderately religious. In other words, religion is important, but they're not regular attendees at religious services, or religion is not important, but they are regular attendees. Okay, so either of those end up in that 26%. And then 32% are non-religious. Religion is not important in their daily life, and they seldom or never attend religious services. So that's almost a third of Americans. When sick or stressed, however, many become religious or use it to cope. You know, when they get sick, when they come to us with medical problems or psychiatric issues. So here at Duke Hospital, we give them a little scale from 0 to 10, and we ask them, to what extent do you use your religious beliefs to cope? Very simple, 0 to 10. And we found was that 40% circled 10. It was the most important factor that enabled them to cope. The most important factor. And then 27% said somewhere between 7.5 and 9.9, that they used it to a large extent, and then another circle somewhere between 5 and 7, another quarter, so that only about 10% were anything under 5 on that scale from 0 to 10. Only 10% circled something under 5, which meant, just a little bit or not much. Okay, so now in coping with stress, it's a common thing in the United States. 90%, this is the New England Journal of Medicine, 90% of people after September 11th, the airplanes flying into the, and causing all that, 3,000 deaths. Everybody was scared and anxious, but 90% turned to religion. But now bear in mind, if you go back, you go back down back here, really, are moderately, but there are a lot of, but some of those people suddenly become religious when bad things happen. Okay, when they get sick or a terrorist, potential for terrorism. So medical settings are particularly. So this is just a little funny thing here. These are agnostic fleas. Fleas. Okay, so here he says, I sometimes wonder if there really is a dog. So here they are sitting on the dog. See the hair? So you get the point. Okay, and then maybe, God, if you're up there, give me a sign. Okay, I'm up here. Here you go. Okay, I think I put these cartoons up every time I come here, and some of you are just getting tired of them. I'm sorry, but, you know, some of you, a few of you haven't seen them yet, so I wanted to show them. Okay, now, many people would like it addressed in their health care by the medical doctor in the United States. Now, this is data from the United States. So 77% say the doctor should consider the patient's spiritual needs. Notice the wording on that. The doctor should consider the patient's spiritual needs. Now, I'm not sure that patients even know what spiritual needs are. I mean, again, it's many people, we're just trying to figure out what this is, just like trying to figure out what spiritual care is. But in any case, 77%, they want their doctor to ask them about their religion or spirituality. There you go, about two-thirds. It goes down some. But in the outpatient setting, 33%, but towards the end of life, about 84%. So when people get really sick, you know, and start towards the end of life, then a lot more are wanting their doctor to, you know, to be aware and ask them about their religious beliefs. Now, the doctor should pray with the patient if requested. Okay, two-thirds of patients say that yes. If they ask the doctor to pray with them, then the doctor should do it. Would like their doctor to pray with them. So that goes down a little bit. And again, it depends on what the setting is. If it's an outpatient setting, a well visit or something like a common cold or a wart, removing a wart, they don't want to be asked. You don't want to be, you know, their doctor to pray with them over a wart, you know, over their cold. They don't want that. But if they're dying or they're seriously ill or have severe chronic illness, then they're more likely to want that. Now, some patients, about a third, want it kept separate. They would like religion and medicine to be separate, you know, that the doctor doesn't mess around with their religion or spirituality and the minister doesn't mess around with their physical health problems. Okay. And then the doctor should not be asking, about 17% say, no, I don't want my doctor asking about my religious or spiritual beliefs. Now, patients were also asked, has a doctor ever asked you in your entire life, brought up the subject of religion or spirituality? And only 1 out of 10 patients said they had. Okay, so from this patient standpoint, from other data that suggests what doctors are actually doing by the doctor's report, it's only about 1 in 10 that that any discussion at all is going on. Now, many patients have spiritual needs related to illness. Now, the best data that we have here are in people with kind of advanced cancer. So these are people with serious chronic, sometimes chronic, you know, kind of short-term chronic cancer. So this was a multi-site study. These are by the Harvard investigators. It's a group of Harvard oncologists, radiation oncologists and other groups that have been doing a series of studies looking at spiritual needs of patients. And so here is a multi-site study. 230 patients, advanced cancer, were surveyed. 88% considered religious to be at least somewhat important. Religion to be at least somewhat important. However, 47% reported that their spiritual needs were minimally or not at all supported by their religious community, and 72% said that their spiritual needs were minimally or not at all supported by the medical system, doctors, nurses, or chaplains, 72%. These are people dying. This is the best case you can imagine that they would have spiritual needs met if you're dying. You know, that if there's one place you ought to be at least being concerned about it is if somebody is dying and there's nothing you can do for them. But still, 72% said that those needs, they had spiritual needs that were not being met by the doctor. Okay. And in fact, furthermore, spiritual support provided by their medical team, or religious communities was associated with higher quality of life. So for those patients who were not part of the 72% or the 47%, that they reported higher quality of life, that somebody was addressing their spiritual needs. Now that's what we're trying to do with dying patients. We want to improve their quality of life. Isn't that the case? We can't cure them, but we want to do something. And here are spiritual needs that we have evidence that if someone addressed them, then maybe that would improve their quality of life. Okay. Now, these are the consequences of not addressing spiritual needs. Well, first of all, it's expensive not to do it. The same research group there at Harvard found that, let's see here. Here is, again, multi-site prospective study of 345 patients. This is a larger sample they got. With advanced cancer who were followed to their death. They found that intensive, expensive, futile, life-prolonging care, mechanical ventilation, resuscitation in the last week of life, was significantly more common among those with higher levels of religious coping. Okay, so now it's getting kind of expensive here, this not addressing spiritual needs, because these religious people are using a lot of expensive technology, the most expensive technology that you could provide them. Ventilator support, you know, intensive care unit. I don't know about you all, but that's pretty expensive. At Duke, it's I don't know how many thousands a day that is. But so they looked, they wanted to find out, well, you know, this is interesting that more religious people are wanting more. Give me everything. You'd think is the opposite. You know, if you believe in God and, you know, you're going to heaven or whatever, you'd say, okay, fine, you'll let me go. But that's not the case. What they found was that those people who were getting their spiritual needs met through spiritual care were not using any more resources than anybody else. It was the patients who had spiritual needs who said they were not being met. They were not getting spiritual care. Those are the ones that were saying, I want it all. Give me everything you got here. I don't want to die. You know, I want to live. It was, and a lot of them were praying for a miracle. That was one issue, you know, but it wasn't being discussed with the medical care team. They were just saying, give me all you got. Because, you know, you don't talk about it. You don't even discuss this in medical settings. And the consequence is high, expensive care towards the end of life because it's not being addressed. Okay, here we go. Religious or spiritual issues are also important for patients in Europe. Okay, so I don't want you to be thinking that, yeah, this is just important in the United States. Everybody in the United States, yeah, they're all religious. We in Europe, no, we're just not, you know, we're not religious here. Well, that is not the case. Weekly religious attendance. This is Arshan's data. Ireland, 81% weekly attendance. Now, these are older adults, admittedly, older adults. Okay, but there'll be some younger adults here, too, in a moment. 81% weekly attendance. Italy, 38%. You know, Spain, 30%. The Netherlands, 27%. And by the way, if you actually, I said, you know, it's 40% attendance in the United States. When you remove those who are lying about it, you end up about 28%. So 28% are attending religious services regularly in the United States. And so there are many countries here in Europe that are just as attending religious services just as common as in the United States. So now there are some countries a little lower, you know, but not all that much lower. Now, here is religious coping in Europe. I'm going to have to move here because I can't read this. Okay, Sweden, some of the northern European countries, there isn't much religious coping going on. That's admittedly. Here are the latest figures. Denmark, 63% believe in God. They don't attend services all that much. Now, that was older data. And the youth, 4% identify with religious groups in this particular study. And of those over 50, 21% pray daily and 30% weekly. So at least those over 50 in Denmark, for example, which is close to northern Europe, a big percentage, and those are the people you're going to see in medical settings, are going to be people over 50. United Kingdom, 27% said religion is important. And although, it's not ranked among healthy people all that high, among the terminally ill, 43% say that spiritual beliefs are, a part of life, or a major part of life, not just part of life, or a major part of life, spiritual beliefs in the United Kingdom. France, 30%, 10% regular attendees. We don't have a lot of data on religious coping from France, but the Netherlands, 33% say religion is important. That's all ages, so one-third of the population say that it's an important part of daily life. And a third, over 50, pray daily. Pray on a daily basis, one-third. And again, that's the population you're going to be seeing in healthcare settings. Germany, 41% religion important, 18% regular attendees, 29% use religion to cope a lot. These are older persons with dentures. That was the only data, only place there's data on it. Older people with dentures. But in patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, that's one of those demyelinating neurological conditions that causes paralysis eventually, and 57% use religion to cope in Germany. And in Italy, 71% religion is important. That's even higher than the United States, 71%. And, that was the highest except for the Greeks. Now, that might be going up in Greece, but we won't say anything about that. Switzerland, 42% religion important, all ages. 42% religion very important or essential for coping among those with schizophrenia. Okay? So thus, the conclusion here is that spiritual care is important in the United States and Europe. That's kind of the conclusion of all of that. So let's look at failure. Now we're going to look quickly at failure to now meet the spiritual needs of patients could affect their mental and physical health. Okay, so we're going to now look at that. It could affect their mental and physical health. And so what I'm going to do now is going to go really quick because I'm going to be running out of time fairly soon here. I'm going to quickly go over the findings in the Handbook of Religion and Health, okay, the new one. So this is the one that just came out a couple of months ago. So this covers a long period of time from 1872 to 2010. It focuses on the last 10 years in particular. And it's a scientific review. It's a systematic review of all literature published in the English language in psychology, sociology, medicine, public health, nursing, the social sciences, behavioral sciences, everything. It captures about 77% of all published research. Doesn't capture it all. It's almost impossible to get it all. But about 77%, if you look at other reviews and compare it, it's picking up about 77% of all studies on health. So just very quickly, we'll go over emotional disorders, positive emotions, social health, and that's kind of that's where we'll end. We won't talk about physical health. Because we're talking about spiritual needs, and those are mostly kind of psychological and social, and so we're going to kind of focus on that. So emotional disorders, there have been 444 quantitative studies, data-based original quantitative studies on religious involvement and spiritual involvement and depression, and looking at recovery from depression and treatments for depression. So of those, about 61% find that, you know, those who are involved in those activities are significantly less depressed, statistically significantly less depressed. And if you look at the higher quality studies that, believe it or not, are mainly measuring religion, you find that two-thirds find this. 6% report more depression. You look at suicide, you find that less suicide, more negative attitudes towards suicide, and less suicide attempts, etc. 75% of the studies consistent with the research on depression, because depression is one of the reasons why people commit suicide. Also, depression in medical settings is very high, very high. In the United States, close to 50% of patients hospitalized in medical settings have a depressive disorder, either major or minor depression. So this is the most common thing that we face in medical settings, is depression. And suicide is an issue. Alcohol and drug abuse, there have been 278 studies actually on just alcohol, 278. 86% report less, and 90% of the best, that's the higher quality in design, larger sample size, better statistics, better controls, report less. Also less drug use, similar figures. Don't want to dwell on this. Well-being and happiness, there have been 326 studies in the world literature in the English language. 256 find greater well-being, more happiness among those who are more religious. And again, if you look at those studies that are looking at religion more specifically, you find that if anything, it goes up. It's at least the same. Lower well-being is present in less than 1% of studies. That's two studies out of 326 quantitative studies found significantly less well-being or lower happiness among those who are more religiously involved. Okay, meaning and purpose in life, almost every study, significantly more hope, more optimism. It's related to more forgiveness, more volunteering, more gratitude, compassion, kindness. These are all quantitative studies. There are all measures of these constructs, you know, out there. And so that's that. Social health, more social support. And of course, in the medical setting, that's important to have a caregiver and to have support. 82%, 93% of the best studies show that that's related to that. And social capital. Social capital. This social capital is a big deal in the United States now. It's a measure of the health of communities. The health. It's made up of how much trust is there among members of a community. How much are people involved in community organizations? Involved in government or school or whatever. Teenage pregnancy rates, drug and alcohol use, crime. These are the kinds of things. So communities that have higher religious involvement have less of those in 80% of the studies, have higher social capital, basically. So, I didn't realize I was going to do that, but anyway, just for your information, here are the physical, more likely to be physically active, less likely to have extramarital sex. Unfortunately, they weigh more religious or heavier. So that's the one where it goes the opposite direction, except maybe in Europe. Maybe it's not that way in Europe. These are mostly United States. Everybody's eating in the United States and not exercising. We don't have, I was talking earlier yesterday, I was saying I think it has to do with the beautiful country here in Europe. At least, you know, seeing Switzerland and some of the surrounding countries, it is gorgeous this time of the year. And so everybody's riding their bicycle. I mean, I'm in the motel, and I can see the path next to the train tracks. Everybody's like groups of people riding their bicycle. You know, you never see anybody riding a bicycle in the United States. Anyway, okay, so less likely to smoke, better diet, you know, lower cholesterol, even more likely to wear their seatbelts. Anyway, I had to show some of those. Actually, I don't have enough time for this, so I'm going to go through it. Okay, this is one slide that shows basically, these are the studies that show complex results. They report, you read the study and you can't figure out what they reported. So we call them complex. Negative, worse health among the more religious. So about 250 studies. A trend towards worse health, about 50 studies. In other words, the p-value is between 0.05 and 0.10. So it's a trend. In the trend, mixed results, in other words, depending on the religious behavior or variable, they may find significant positive or significant negative relationships with health. Next one is a trend showing that religious people are healthier, but it's only in the trend direction. And then this one is the statistically significant positive relationships, quantitative relationships between religion and health. And then no association in those. So, addressing spiritual needs, I think, is important. That if people are having some conflicts here, then that could influence things down the road, including, you know, health. So this is kind of a model of, you know, the source, belief in and attachment to God within a monotheistic religious tradition, which I'm assuming that most of you are members of monotheistic, but we've actually got diagram for the Eastern religions and for secular humanism as well. But for now, this is the quickest one to show you. Belief in attachment to God, giving rise to these theological virtues of faith in God, hope in God, love of God, and that being nurtured within a faith community and that giving rise to religious practices. Now you can see here that I'm equating spirituality with religion. Okay, yes, that's what I'm doing. So, but that's another lecture. But in any case, this then giving rise to what are called psychological traits or virtues, your forgiveness, honesty, courage, self-discipline, altruism, humility, gratefulness, patience, dependability. And these factors, of course, influencing social relationships. Almost all major world religions endorse these traits. Almost all world religions, not just Christianity, all world religions encourage this. Buddhism, Hinduism, but again, we're just talking about monotheistic religions. And this affecting, again, social relationships, positive emotions, helping to neutralize negative emotions, affecting immune, endocrine, and cardiovascular functions because of the mind-body relationship. We know that stress levels, you know, depression, alter the physiology, affect your body in ways that are destructive, affect the cardiovascular system, the endocrine system, cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine. And so if these negative emotions affect this, and there's some evidence that positive emotions actually enhance these systems, optimism, hope, well-being, appears there's some evidence that actually enhances these systems, not just the negative emotions don't just destroy those systems, but these factors potentially enhance those systems. And so if that's the case, then this could lead to better health, greater longevity, if this is, you know, if this is in good shape, you know, this attachment to God. If it's not in good shape, you know, then it might in fact have the opposite result. And there is evidence, too, that religious struggles, spiritual struggles in medical settings where many patients feel that God is punishing them, has deserted them, they're angry at God, they feel that their church has deserted them. They don't want to have anything to do with religion at all, but they're angry about it. And that leads to greater death. And there's a series of studies showing that seems to be correlated with impaired immune functions, as well as almost every physical, you know, measure indicator of physical health. That when people are struggling emotionally, spiritually, that this is not good for your health or the medical outcomes, and that's a good reason to be identifying spiritual needs and providing spiritual care to address those. Okay, so thus, spiritual care is important for medical reasons, psychological reasons, social reasons, and financial reasons. Okay, so there are lots of reasons why it's important. So how does a health professional provide spiritual care? Health professional, at least in the United States, I'm talking about that. Take a screening spiritual history, a 2 to 4 minute spiritual history. So this is for healthcare professionals. We're not talking about clergy or chaplains, just healthcare professionals that are not trained in, you know, addressing spiritual needs. So it's screening, a little screening to identify. The purpose is to obtain information about religious background, beliefs, rituals that are relevant to the mental health care of the patient and also physical health care. If patients indicate from the start they are not religious or spiritual, then you ought to drop the subject. That's what we encourage people. Don't continue to ask about it. If they say, well, this is really not, I'm not very religious, and I'm really not interested in spiritual things either. Okay, that's the end. Now you know. Now you know that you don't have to do anything more in that area. Now you should explain why you're taking the spiritual history. Okay, because otherwise patients will panic. You know, when do you start talking about religion? You know, it's got to be pretty bad. So you want to explain that you don't want the patient to become alarmed or anxious if their health professional starts talking about religious or spiritual issues. Health professionals should be careful not to send the unintended message that may be misinterpreted. Make it clear that such inquiry has nothing to do with the patient's diagnosis or severity of their medical condition. Nothing. That it's simply routine. Such inquiry is routine, kind of required, and an attempt to be sensitive. You know, you don't have to say required. In the States, well, it's a stretch to call it required, but, you know, in palliative care, it is required. Palliative care, taking a spiritual history is required in palliative care settings according to the standards in the U.S. But it's routine attempt to be sensitive to the spiritual needs that some patients may have. Not all patients, but some patients. And you're trying to be culturally appropriate and sensitive to spiritual beliefs if they're relevant. If they're not, fine. You know, fine. But if they are, then you want to address them. So here's kind of a spiritual history. I actually would like the physician to be doing the spiritual history, but, you know, doctors aren't doing it. Unfortunately, the patient needs to feel comfortable talking with their physician about spiritual issues because they influence medical decision making. That's why, you know, there ought to be some communication in that regard. Here's the religious struggles I was talking about earlier, people feeling God abandoned them, felt punished by God, you know, all of this. They score higher on this, they're going to die sooner. Very simple. Irregardless of their physical health, their psychological state, or their social relationships, they're going to die sooner if they have these beliefs, these religious struggles. So here's God at his computer. See? The smite button. Is there a word for smite here in Europe too? Smite is like, you know, like that kind of smiting. So anyway, that's that. Here's the spiritual history. Okay, this is the kind of information on a screening spiritual history. Is the patient's religious or spiritual background, what is it? What's their religious or spiritual background, if any? Are there any beliefs that might be used to cope with illness, or alternatively, might be a source of stress or distress? Are there any beliefs that might conflict with the medical or psychiatric care or influence medical decisions? Is a person involved in a religious or spiritual community, and is that community supportive? You know, supportive to them after they go back home. Spiritual needs, any spiritual needs that might be present that need to be addressed for health reasons. That's kind of what you're after. You're really after identifying these spiritual needs that are present that need to be addressed for health reasons. Okay, so that's that. Medical doctors say it's important, but don't do it. That's the bottom line on that slide. Besides taking a spiritual history, support the religious or spiritual beliefs of the patient. Support whatever those beliefs are, whatever those spiritual beliefs are. Be supportive. Ensure the patient has resources to support their spirituality. Usually you connect them with somebody who's skilled and trained to address spiritual needs. Accommodate the environment to meet the spiritual needs of the patient. And be willing to communicate with patients about spiritual issues. Prescribe religion to improve health. What about that? Probably not a good idea. Not a good idea. Don't do it. You're not about prescribing religion here. You're about identifying the spiritual needs of the patient in their own language and supporting those, you know, identifying them and supporting that person's spirituality, whatever it is. Pray with patients. I don't see a problem with that if the patient asks. I don't see why a healthcare professional couldn't say a short prayer. And they don't even have to pray. They just let the patient pray. Say, okay, let's pray. I'll just sit here while you pray. You know, and let the patient do the praying. That way, actually, you learn a lot. Since I'm a psychiatrist, now I don't pray with patients very often, but when I have and I've asked them to pray, you learn a lot about them that you never got in the history. You know, and there you didn't realize just they prioritize things when they pray. You know, so anyway. Refer to chaplains, okay, that's the main thing, and provide care in a spiritual way, and I'm going to stop. Provide care, so this doesn't take any extra time at all. The way health care is provided by physicians, nurses, social workers, counselors, physical therapists, occupational therapists can be spiritual. In other words, recognizing the sacred nature of the person and the holy obligation and privilege that health professionals have. Okay, I'm going to repeat that again. Right. The way healthcare is provided can be spiritual. Recognizing the sacred nature of the person and the holy obligation and privilege that health professionals have. So what does that mean? Okay, it means providing care with respect for the individual patient. You know, everybody's different. So providing care and getting kind of clues from the patient themselves as a unique individual. Inquiring about how the patient wishes to be cared for rather than assuming that you know. Ask the patient. Provide care in a kind and gentle manner. Provide care in a competent manner. A competent manner. That's what, you know, that's what patients, you know, that's why they're there, is to get competent medical care. Take extra time with patients who really need it. Okay, so that involves some sacrifice on our part too. You know, taking extra time with people who really need it. That's part of spiritual care in my understanding of it. It's not without a cost. This is not easy to do. Okay, so Do not prescribe religion to non-religious patients. Don't force a spiritual history if the patient's not religious. Don't coerce patients in any way to believe or practice. Don't pray with patient before taking a spiritual history and unless the patient asks. Do not spiritually counsel patients. Leave it up to trained professional chaplains or pastoral counselors. Don't do any activity that is not patient-centered and patient-directed. Okay? So in summary, there's a solid rationale for addressing the patient's spiritual needs. Many patients in the United States and Europe are religious or spiritual and have spiritual needs that must be addressed. Identify spiritual needs by taking a spiritual history and explore the role that spiritual factors play in either coping with illness or contributing to illness. Utilize trained professional chaplains or pastoral counselors to address the patient's spiritual needs. And here's some further reading. And here's our website. Every month we have a newsletter that goes out. It's free. Summarizes the latest research. I basically write it. It's about 3 or 4 pages. It's a pretty quick read. Just sign up here. Go to our website. See that? Sign up for that newsletter. After you've signed up for Renee's newsletter, which is every 3 months, what are you going to do in those intervening 3 months? See? Right there. You read this newsletter. Okay. So, and then any of you are interested and couldn't make the workshop, on how to conduct research in this area, we have it in the summer, every summer. So here's my email if you're interested. Very simple, harold.koenig.edu. Okay, so here we are.